Chapter 7. The Elven Embassy was just a couple of tiers down from Andoran's pinnacle. It was a palatial mansion built from granite, but in the spiraling, flowing style of the elves, so that the building seemed to be poured from the heavens rather than built from the ground. House crests were grown from the wall, living emblems made from trees guided into impossible shapes by elven wild singers and decorated with the totems of each elven house. Oak branches grew through a bear skull for House Galantia, while maple entwined boar tusks for House Loeren, and cherry wrapped around a stag's antlers for House Tyrieth, and so on.
"This place clearly has some gold about it,"
Laruna noted, admiring the architecture.
"It's got real gargoyles, not the cheap carvings."
Gorm harumphed.
"Look, that one's sunning its wings," Laruna said. "How do they even get them to stay on the roof?"
"You have to raise the gargoyle from hatchlings to get them that tame," said Caitha. "And even then you should keep small pets indoors."
Gorm harumphed again. "It's ridiculous extravagance. You can't trust someone with too much gold."
"And how much is too much gold?" said Caitha.
"You can just tell when someone's got too much," Gorm said. "Training monsters to be ornaments, or putting cats in chainmail, or hiring gnomes to dress up and prance about the garden."
"Interesting," said Jin. "I've always thought dwarves were particularly enamored with gold."
"I liked it more back when it was actually gold," said Gorm.
He produced a gilton and bit it. The coin bent easily, flaking gilt away from its tin center.
"Gold today's like a child's trinkets."
Jin shrugged.
"A gilton is just a symbol, a tiny unit of power. Currency is a system of control, and coins and banknotes are how it's measured."
"I've never thought of it that way," said Heraldin.
"Most people don't. Then again, they don't see the warp or the weft of magic, either," said Jin. "It's the way of the world. Power eludes the masses, and so the masses are ruled by the few."
"And then the few go crazy and start carrying kobolds in their purses," said Gorm.
They were stopped at the front gate by elven bannermen in jade and gold armor. Niln presented their credentials to a tall elven captain wearing a striking golden cape. The guard reviewed the quest paperwork, the embassy invitation, and each of the hero's guild certifications. He paused when he looked at Gorm's license.
"Rank one?" he asked with a smile.
"Technically,"
Gorm said. He mentally added the captain to his list of people who had made the wrong list. The elf grinned, handed the papers back to Niln, and waved them along.
"Move through."
"Not you," he added.
"Grongrot?"
asked Gleebeck.
"No shadowkin in the embassy," said the guard. "He can wait over there. Hear that, Gobbo? You wait there."
"Ain't a shadowkin. He's me squire," said Gorm.
A few of the guards chortled.
"I've never heard of a slime-skin squire, even for a mind-drek at rank one," said the captain, cramming multiple slurs into what was perhaps the most spectacularly ill-advised comment of his life.
Gorm grinned, or perhaps bared his teeth. Even he didn't know, truth be told. The only thing that was certain was that whenever he smiled that way, events tended to get interesting. His first punch took a few teeth from the guard's smile, his second cracked the elf's ribs, and after that he lost track, until Caitha interrupted him.
"Mr. Ingerson," the ranger shouted, "is looking forward to having the remainder of his ranks restored, because now he is a proper hero once more, and doing things within the bounds of the law."
"Well,"
Gorm started to protest.
"Plus, we wouldn't want to upset Master Niln," Caitha added pointedly.
The high scribe stared at the prone guard, pale and slack-jawed. Gorm reluctantly lifted his boot off the captain's face.
"Aye, sorry," he said, sheathing his axe. "Been living the rough life on the road too long, I guess. Forgotten me manners."
He offered a hand to help the captain up, but the terrified elf slid himself back on his good arm and gurgled something or other. It was hard to understand a man without a functioning jaw. Several of the other guards shrank away, clutching their weapons in feeble imitations of defense.
"Somebody get the man a healing potion," Jin said.
"Aye, that'll grow those teeth back,"
Gorm told the terrified captain.
"We'll continue to our meeting," Caitha said. "Squire Gleebeck will wait for us here."
"But,"
Gorm started. "We've created enough paperwork here already," Laruna said.
"I think discretion is the better part of whatever that was supposed to be," Haraldin added.
Caitha nodded. "No disrespect, but Gleebeck can remain outside."
Gleebeck approached Gorm and patted his arm.
"Gleebeck, Gagobzog."
The goblin nodded reassuringly as he went to sit on the bench the elven captain had directed him to. Gorm sighed.
"Come on, let's get this over with."
Niln, rubbing his forehead, fell into step beside Gorm once they were through the gate.
"Mr. Ingerson, we can't... What do you think the guild will have to say about us assaulting embassy guards?"
"Oh, I'd say 30 or 40.
"Years? In prison?
What? No! We'll be fined 30 or 40 gilden."
"That's all? You assaulted bannermen."
"Aye, but we're heroes in the line of duty. Happens all the time. The rules are different for us, lad."
"A man on the street could lose his head for throwing a stone at a bannerman, and you're saying we'll pay a small fine for... I'm not even sure what exactly you did to him back there."
"Broken jaw, fractured ribs, fairly certain he lost several teeth."
"That wasn't a request for more detail."
"Fair enough," Gorm shrugged. "Point is, we might have more leeway with city guards than a man on the street, but that man wouldn't hang for breaking a contract, would he? Now me, if I left your temple tonight, I'd be swinging from a rope in the morning. We're under guild law now. Some rules matter less, and some matter a lot more."
Niln scowled.
"Still, Mr. Ingerson, I think we should abide by all of the law, not just the parts that you think matter."
"Aye, sorry. Old habits die hard."
"Diplomatic relations die easy."
"Then they shouldn't have barred me, squire, from entering."
"I'm sure no harm will be done to him."
"Harm's already been done,"
snapped Gorm. The chambers of House Tyriath were on the top floor of the embassy. The house's sigil grew in the sun provided by a large oculus in one of the building's twisting domes. It was a cherry tree, grown into a perfect circle that spiraled around a great pair of antlers, yellow and white banners streaming beneath. Trained songbirds flitted among the leaves.
"You should see it in the spring in bloom," Caitha said.
A waiting attendant guided them through the house chambers. The floors were stained oak, and the granite walls were decorated with mosses and rare blooms. The furniture was made from dark cherry wood carved into sleek, fluid shapes and decorated with carvings of leaves and cherry blossoms. The heroes were led to a medium-sized room with an oblong table and broad picture windows overlooking the embassy gardens. Gorm walked to the window and gazed out over the exquisitely manicured trees and flowers while he waited. One by one, most of the other heroes joined him.
"It's beautiful," said Laruna. "It has to be," said Caitha.
"Caitha?"
said a voice from the door. Gorm turned to see an elven woman in the doorway. Her amber hair was pulled into a tight bun, and she wore a smart suit jacket and short skirt, both in shades of cherry blossom pink. She also carried a large leather purse.
"Jelana?" said Caitha.
The two women emitted a high-pitched squeal of the kind Gorm had heard when horrible monsters attacked villages, and then they ran across the room and clasped each other in a lukewarm embrace.
"How long has it been?" Jelana asked.
"I don't know, 40 years,
said Caitha.
"And so much has changed," said Jelana. "I'm the ambassador to Andoran now, and you're with the Almatrans. Oh, Mother always said you were touched by Almatra. And somehow everything seems to stay the same."
Caitha's smile suddenly seemed more brittle.
"Speaking of which, how is Mother now?" "Oh, you know, the same."
"You two are sisters?"
Gorm said. Now that they said it, he could see a distinct resemblance. The elves shared a knowing look.
"Sort of," said Jelana. "Queen Gwelineth always has 3 daughters,
Caitha said.
"Your princesses?" exclaimed Laruna.
"We used to be,"
Jelana said.
"Mother follows the old ways."
Gorm had met a few elves who stuck to the old ways. Some couldn't stand the idea of losing their identity as their memories faded, of literally losing themselves every few centuries and having to find someone new again. When you couldn't trust your own mind to tell you who you were, and thus who you are now, the only way to know for sure that you hadn't changed was to never change at all.
Followers of the old ways stayed within the same cycles, endlessly repeating the same events and reinforcing the identity they clung to. Some did so at great expense and effort. Gorm recalled hearing about the sad case of an elven couple that forever lived on the edge of poverty so they could save enough to marry each other in a lavish ceremony every decade or so.
"The queen always has three daughters," said Caitha, "the babe, the girl, and the maid. When the time comes for a new daughter, the babe becomes the girl, and the girl the maid, and the maid moves on," said Jelana.
"So what does she do if she has a son?" Haraldin asked.
"There's a reason we couldn't socialize with the stable boys," said Caitha.
"It works well. We're offered prominent positions, ambassadors, advisors, treasurers, and the like," said Jelana. "Of course, some of her daughters wander away, much to mother's disappointment."
"Mother never liked my career choices," Caitha explained.
"Oh, I wouldn't say that. She didn't mind them, when you were successful."
An icy silence descended. Jin cleared his throat.
"Well, shall we get to the business at hand?" Niln said, beckoning them to sit at the table.
Jelana's handbag shook and wriggled when she set it down.
"Looks like someone's waking up," she said.
A gnarled canine face peeked over the top of the bag. It had bulging eyes and mismatched teeth and wild tufts of white hair sprouting from its eyebrows and chin. A kobold. Gorm shot Jin a pointed look. The wizard shrugged and held up his hands. The kobold yawned, stretching his arms as he stepped out of the bag. His tiny blue and white suit had a small hole in the seat for his tail.
"Isn't he the cutest? Oh, he's the cutest. Yes, he is."
"I thought you didn't allow Shadowkin in here," said Gorm.
"Well, we make exception for the cutest widow kobold ever, don't we?"
Jelana set the kobold on her lap.
"Boots is the honorable ambassador of adorable, isn't he? Yes, he is. Yes, he is."
The kobold nuzzled into the elf's lap and gave Gorm a smug smile.
"If we could focus on the business at hand," said Niln.
He removed the velvet pouch from his robes, and from it he produced the lone elven marble. Jelana's face lit up when he placed the stone on the table.
"You found it already? Oh, thank Tandos. That didn't take nearly as long as I expected."
"There are said to be four more of the marbles, my lady," said Niln. "This was entrusted to me by the king."
"Oh,"
Jelana seemed annoyed.
"Well, look, House Tyriath is very upset about this whole business with the artwork. It's a cultural treasure or something."
"From what I hear, that's what the orcs are saying, too," said Gorm.
"What? Really? Oh, who cares?"
Jelana gave the kobold another treat.
"Besides, the orcs can't take proper care of the sculptures or protect them, right? I mean, the sculptures were broken and looted, right?"
"By your house," said Gorm.
"Thank you, Mr. Ingerson," said Niln.
"Look, it's simple. House Tyriath demands that the marbles be returned."
Jelana's grimace faded as she turned her attention to her kobold.
"Is that a good nom-nom, Boots? Yes, it is. Yes, it is."
"Can you tell us who might have wanted to steal the marbles?" Niln asked.
"Well, the orcs, like your dwarf said. And House Galantia has always envied our artworks. They're collectors too, you know. Last week at the embassy ball, Calathane of Galantia had the nerve to call our gallery banal. Can you believe it? Well, I wouldn't stand for it."
The meeting degenerated into an update on the latest gossip as lunch was served. Gorm was starving, but the food was elven. He half-heartedly poked his spoon at what seemed to be a piece of jellied spinach before turning his attention to the marble in the center of the table. He picked it up, stared into the angry eyes, and felt the tusks from the vicious underbite. Something caught his eye when he flipped the statue over. A small sigil was stamped in faded indigo ink on the bottom of the statue, at the base of the neck, where the head had been sawn from the original sculpture. It was a fish pointing downward, but its mouth opened in a fearsome, sharp-toothed star ringed by a pattern of tentacles. Two appendages were longer than the rest, wrapping around the fish to create a perfect circle.
"What's this symbol here?"
he interrupted the story of some house's slight against some other house. The marble was passed around the table, but nobody seemed to have seen it before.
"I don't know," said Jelana, examining the stamp. "Maybe the museum curator put it there for some reason? No, Boots, down! Down! There's a good boy!"
A knock sounded, and an elf dressed in a smart suit entered. His face looked remarkably like that of the captain of the guard at the front gate, or at least before Gorm was through with him.
"A message for you, Madam Ambassador,"
the elf said. He handed Jelana a dossier.
Oh, this is wonderful news, she said, reading the files. We think we know where the other marbles are.
We have word that suggests the marbles were taken by bandits, explained the messenger. They have made camp in the outskirts of the Meyerwood, not half a day's ride from Ebenmeyer. An uncomfortable silence settled around the table.
That's excellent, said Heraldin. Heroes of destiny, quick huddle.
The heroes pulled into a tight ring at one end of the table and leaned their heads in close.
How is that wonderful news? Heraldin hissed. The marbles are in the bloody Meyerwood.
Ugh, said Laruna. I don't want to go wading through some festering swamp brimming with foul monsters.
Isn't that professional heroics?
Said Niln.
Professional implies there's money involved, whispered Caitha. The Meyerwood got looted clean 30 years ago. Everything that's crept back in is poorer than dirt.
And also homicidally insane, said Heraldin.
You can make a name for yourself killing horrible monsters, but it's loot that pays the bills, said Laruna.
The Meyerwood is a lot of risk for little reward, said Jin.
Not if the elven marbles are in there, said Niln. They're the object of our quest.
Yes, said Heraldin, the quest that was supposed to be easy, right, dwarf? A simple walk to pick up some sculptures and be on our way. Wasn't that what you said? And now we'll probably be eaten alive by giant blood leeches.
Gorm had been through the Meyerwood before. He'd helped clear the thrice-cursed swamp of monsters in one of his early campaigns. But he'd been with a well-organized party then, every hero a hardened veteran with years of monster-hunting experience, and they'd still lost a few. You couldn't bring new bloods like Niln or Jin into the Meyerwood. They'd just be dead weight, in more ways than one. Still, that had been on a journey to the swamp's center.
That fellow said the marbles are on the outskirts of the swamp, Gorm said.
So what? Said Laruna.
The edges of the Meyerwood ain't so bad, Gorm explained. That's why bandits camp there. Everyone's scared of the swamp, but the nastiest things of the Meyer stay nearer to the middle. We should be fine, provided we stay near the outskirts.
Assuming he's right, said Heraldin.
All eyes turned back to the elves of House Tyriath. The messenger smiled at them and handed Niln the dossier of intelligence. Jelana treated Boots to a vigorous tummy rub.
How sure are you that the marbles are on the outskirts of the swamp? Said Niln, studying the documents.
And not in the parts with the giant blood leeches, added Heraldin.
We have good information indicating as much, said the messenger.
What kind of information? Asked Gorm.
Good, reiterated the elf, in a manner that clearly indicated he wasn't revealing his sources. The heroes resumed their huddle.
Do we trust him? Said Jin.
Do we have any better leads? Said Niln.
Do we even have a choice? Said Heraldin.
No, no, and no, said Gorm. Unless we get a better lead, we're going to the Meyerwood.
Dwin Poldo entered the black marble and glass office of Goldson and Bags with a growing sense of trepidation. The binder in his hand overflowed with reports and charts and tables of numbers. None of them were encouraging.
Welcome, Mr. Poldo, said Mr. Goldson, without glancing up from his ledger. We trust you have news,
added Bags, scrawling on a parchment with his heavy quill.
Yes, sirs,
said Poldo, stepping forward with a nervous cough. He opened his file and read from his notes.
Setharoth, the serpent priest, is dead, and the cult of Setha has been cleared from the Black Temple.
Ah, excellent, said Bags. I'm sure the citizens of Burley Crest and Fenrose Heath are resting easier tonight.
How was the loot, then? Asked Goldson.
In Poldo's experience, Mr. Goldson was always more to the point than Mr. Bags. The point was always money.
The hoard was approximately 40% of projections, said Poldo. All of the plunder funds have taken a massive loss. Three smaller firms folded when the haul came in.
I'm sure our funds were suitably insured, said Bags.
Yes, sir,
said Poldo uncertainly. Goldson finally looked up from his ledger.
And yet you don't seem reassured.
All of our funds were insured by Lamia Sisters through one of their subsidiaries, sir, said Poldo. And as we've insured all of their funds through one of our own subsidiaries, we've ended up owing each other about 5 million gilton, with the balance sheets no better off for it.
Mr. Bags was about to respond when a small chime rang out. They turned to the back wall of the room, where numerous crystals were arrayed in a neat grid, each with a small bronze plaque beneath it. One of the crystals glowed with a faint emerald light and still hummed with residual sorcery.
"Mr. Poldo, would you be so kind?" said Mr. Goldson.
"Yes, sir,"
said Poldo. He hurried across the room, adjusted his spectacles, and read the small, polished placard beneath the crystal.
"It's a green light from one Relic Investment Group, sirs."
"Ah," said Mr. Baggs, "it seems things are shaping up nicely. Perhaps. Mr. Poldo, join us for a drink,"
said Mr. Goldson. Poldo wasn't in much of a mood for celebration, but he hurried to retrieve the drinks from an ebony cabinet regardless. He set three glasses and an ice bucket on an ornate mahogany tray, selected a bottle of fine Duero spirits, and poured three drinks. Mr. Goldson took his liquor with two ice cubes. Mr. Baggs preferred his neat. Poldo made his a double. It was that kind of day.
"I'm not so sure things will turn out as well as you think they will," said Mr. Goldson as Poldo set his drink on the table. "I'm completely sure they won't," said Mr. Baggs. "That's why we have contingencies." "One contingency? I'm told it's a good one."
Mr. Baggs raised his glass.
"To plans well laid and profits well earned." "To new beginnings," said Mr. Goldson, joining the toast. "And the good old days."
Mr. Goldson and Mr. Baggs turned to Poldo, both wearing small, expectant smiles. Poldo raised his own glass.
"Cheers,"
he said. Gorm and the heroes were leaving the courtyard of the Elven Embassy when an aide in green and indigo robes rushed to catch them. The messenger breathlessly greeted them all and paid respects to Niln before he addressed Gorm directly.
"Mr. Ingerson, if we may detain you a little longer, your presence is required in the lower chambers."
"What about?" said Gorm.
"I'm not at liberty to say, sir."
"It might have something to do with the spontaneous dental work you gave the captain of the guard," said Heraldin.
"Thank you, Heraldin," said Niln.
"It's probably bloody paperwork," grumbled Gorm. "Insurance forms and all that."
The aide assured Gorm that it wasn't paperwork and wouldn't take long. Niln assented to the diversion, and so Gorm agreed to meet them back at the temple.
"Take Gleebeck back with you," he told them.
He followed the aide back to the embassy, but instead of entering through the front door, they walked around the side of the building. They took servants' paths past the sprawling gardens, hidden by carefully placed hedges and strategically grown trees. A cleverly concealed staircase led them down to a small grotto where the elves kept their servants' entrance. The aide took his leave. For a while, Gorm leaned against the grotto's mouth and listened to the songbirds above him. The air smelled of moss and summer tea blossoms. He heard the oaken service door open and close behind him, but he didn't see anyone standing there when he turned.
"Down here,"
said a raspy voice. Gorm adjusted his gaze earthward.
"Boots?"
"Ha! That's my stage name," said the kobold.
He leaned against the wall opposite Gorm, struck a match on his teeth, and lit a small cob pipe.
"You can call me Bert."
"They brought me back here to talk to a purse kobold?"
"Whoa, hey! Look at Mr. High and Mighty denigrating my career," said Bert. "And here I thought I was trying to help, but what could a lowly handbag performer offer a professional hero?"
"I was just surprised," Gorm backpedaled.
"Shocking that a purse kobold would dare talk to a hero, huh? Maybe I should have looked at all of the other great career options available to a young kobold, right? I could have been a sewer worker like my cousin Thibaut. Of course, he got eaten by something down there, but this is Andoran, right? All right, settle down."
The kobold champed on his pipe and waved his hands animatedly.
"And hey, I could have been a gutter runner, right? I mean, I've known a friend or two who got blown off the rooftops, but if they pooled their wages, they could almost afford food and rent. Okay, look, I get food, I get good pay, and I ain't at much risk of dying. It's a good gig. More kobolds should be so lucky."
Bert scratched a tuft of hair above his bulging eyes.
"Course, most ain't got the face for it."
"I didn't mean nothing, all right?"
Bert chewed his pipe furiously and glared up at Gorm, his paws firmly on his hips.
"Yeah, I guess not," he said.
He took a deep breath.
"Is it true what they said? You took down old Captain Nathalar in a fight?"
"Bones," swore Gorm.
"Word travels fast. You hear things when you're in a purse. People forget you're there, or that you can talk."
Bert puffed furiously on the pipe, conjuring clouds of glaucous smoke.
So it's true, then?
Aye, it's true.
And you did it for a goblin? Just because the guards wouldn't let him in?
I suppose I did.
Not many dwarves would stick their neck out for a shadowkin, said Bert. Then again, not many dwarves would have mentioned the orc's claim on those statues to the elven ambassador.
I'd like to think quite a few would, said Gorm.
I'd like to as well, but you and I both know they wouldn't.
Gorm shrugged. The kobold was right, but acknowledging as much was difficult. It was always hard to talk about Shadowkin with Shadowkin.
Takes a strange kind of dwarf to stick his neck out for a goblin and some orcs, said Bert.
The kobold scrutinized Gorm with bulbous, mismatched eyes, looking for some hint of reaction. When Gorm gave him none, he pressed further.
Maybe the same kind of dwarf who'd give the statues to the orcs if he found them?
Whoa, slow down, said Gorm. I ain't agreeing to that.
No, no, of course you ain't, said Bert. But you may be the type who might do it, if he had good reason.
It ain't my decision to make.
You got influence. I saw the way the high scribe looks to you for advice. The rest of them listen to you. You could put in a good word.
Why does a kobold care whether the orcs get the marbles anyway? Bert shook his head and took a slow drag from his pipe.
Because if they get them, that would mean somebody recognized them. That a king, or his chosen champion or whoever, picked the Shadowkin over the Lightlings. It'd make them somebody. And then we kobolds, all the gnolls really, and the goblins and the gremlins, we'd all be a little more somebody too, you know?
Don't talk nonsense. Everybody is somebody, said Gorm.
I'm somebody as long as I got these thrice-cursed papers,
said the kobold, pulling a tiny green booklet from his coat.
I'm somebody as long as a washed-up princess wants me in her purse. We ain't like you lightlings, waking up every morning and wondering what you want to do, where you think you should go. I wake up every morning and wonder what they'll let me do, what I can get away with. 'Cause any day I cross them, they'll take away my papers, and then I'm nothing again. Fodder for some hero's license, a dead dog walking. Think about the orcs and ogres, the kobolds and gnolls, the slaw and the nagas, the goblins and gremlins. Know any rich ones? Know any nobles? Thinking of any connections you're glad to have or would like to make? No, because we're nobody. Or at least, we're less somebody than you. Shadowkin, never win, Lightling. We can't win.
Sorry, said Gorm. Bert waved off the empty apology.
I know you can't promise me anything. I know you don't get to make the call. And even if you did, you might not be able to make it our way. I get it. Just make me this deal. I give you a tip about those rocks, and you think about giving them to the orcs if you find them. Just a thought, that's all I'm asking.
Aye, conceded Gorm, shaking his head.
I can't say it will do you any good, but I'll think it over.
Good.
Bert leaned back against the wall and looked around conspiratorially.
I recognized the stamp, he said.
The what?
The stamp! Blue ink on the bottom of the statue looked like a fish squid.
Bert leaned toward Gorm, stood on tiptoe, and whispered,
That's the seal of the Leviathan Project.
What's the Leviathan Project? Shush! Shh!
Hushed the kobold.
Look, I don't know what it was, but I know a guy who was on it, and it was bad. We're talking about some heavy stuff here, dwarf. Dark magic and dark secrets, right? I don't know why the stamp's on the statue, but it isn't good news for you or for anybody. You want to know more, you go talk to one of each Magrash.
How many Magrashes are there?
Oh, there's only one of them. One of each is his name. You'll see. Orc working the sewers down near the base. Look in Sculpin Downs.
Gorm nodded. That's all?
That's a lot.
Aye, said Gorm. Aye, it was. Thank you.
For what? Said Bert. This conversation never happened. I was never even down here. I was up getting ready to head to the groomers, see?
Course you were, said Gorm. Goodbye, Bert.
So long, Lightling.
Bert stopped at the door and shot Gorm a pointed look.
What's a guy gotta do to get let in?
Oh, sorry. Gorm opened the old oak door. Bert stopped halfway indoors.
You'll think about them orcs, won't you?
Aye, lied Gorm.
I will.
The kobold nodded and left Gorm to his thoughts. He had a lot of them. Jin shook his head.
Wrong. Again.
Laruna knew he would say that.
The phrase was the beat behind the endless drone of these thrice-cursed training sessions. She had spent every spare moment of her day standing in the same bleak, empty, and recently charred courtyard behind the temple, hurling fire at a wall of scorched stone while listening to Jin's ceaseless litany of correction. She'd sent more flame blasts and fireballs at the far wall than even she thought possible, leaving her drained, exhausted. She felt like a husk of herself.
"I need to rest."
"Again," said Jin. A sudden flash of annoyance flared up within her. Laruna stoked her irritation by thinking of Jin and his inept lessons, of the dwarf who had suggested this ridiculous arrangement, and of Niln who had allowed it. The spark grew into anger, and then into a rage that seared down her arms and leaped from her hands as a pair of fireballs, which she flung at the stone ridge. The spells hadn't hit the ridge before Jin spoke. "Wrong. Again."
"How many times do I have to do this?" breathed Laruna. "I don't even know what you want."
"I want you to channel 2 threads. Try again."
"I can't."
She was beyond anger, beyond caring. "Again."
"Don't talk to me like I'm an apprentice," she said.
"An apprentice? This is how I train neophytes. This is the first lesson on the first day." Tears welled in Laruna's eyes. She was too tired to care.
"I can't."
"You can. You have enviable power, Laruna, but you don't wield it like a mage. You must learn to weave magic instead of just throwing it." "Now, again."
"This is how I cast spells."
"We are here to unlearn your bad habits." "Again." Laruna raised her hands and reached out, straining to find magic that wasn't tied to her emotions. To her surprise, she felt something, a faint heat, a whisper of fire building around her fingertips. She gasped as 2 thin tendrils of golden light sprouted from her palm and wavered upward. The magic wasn't flame, yet it was the essence of flame, dancing uncertainly in her hand.
"I did it," she whispered. "I'm weaving."
Jin nodded. "Now split the thread."
"No, I'm actually weaving. I've never done this before."
"You still haven't, technically. Split the thread, and then we'll weave them."
"I mean, this is new. This is progress. You could say as much," growled Laruna,
shaking her hands at the wizard in frustration. The gesture disrupted her concentration, and the feeble threads of magic dissipated. "Wrong," said Jin. "Again." Laruna looked at her empty hands and then back to the wizard. Jin stared back at her impassively. "Again," he repeated. The apathy and exhaustion burned away in a blaze of white-hot fury, searing from her very core outward as she loosed an enraged scream. A pillar of flame erupted from the ground beneath her feet, soaring higher than the temple walls for a moment before she loosed the spell. The whole courtyard was lost in a maelstrom of fire and heat, with Laruna screaming her hatred and anger in the middle of it. By the time the flames left her, Laruna didn't even have the strength to stand. She dropped to the ground next to Jin, just as his magical shield winked out of existence. It seemed like an eternity before she felt her arms again, and even longer before her breathing calmed. "Are you all right?"
"Shut up,"
Laruna rasped, pushing herself to her knees. "Good," he said. "That was wrong. Again."